Collins. Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, January 31st, 2018. And yeah, Trump gave a speech to a joint session of Congress last night. The State of the Union is fabulous, wonderful, beautiful, incredible, and it's all because of him. And we'll get to that, but there's more important news to lead with today, including a court case in Kansas, where a federal judge has struck down a Kansas law that penalized people who support boycott, divestment, and sanctions aimed at the State of Israel. The law, which is modeled on many others that have been passed around the country, was pretty extreme. And the case that the ACLU brought to challenge the law came from a teacher named Esther Kuntz, who is a member of the Mennonite Church, and she works for the Kansas public school system. And she and her church embraced BDS. And so when she was offered a contract with the Kansas public school system, she was asked to sign a certification confirming that she was not participating in a boycott of Israel based on the new law in Kansas. So she said she's not willing to sign such an oath because she is, in fact, participating in a boycott of Israel. So the ACLU brought suit, and the court has ruled firmly in her favor. It not only underscored the right of individuals under the First Amendment to engage in economic boycotts, and it's based on law and precedent that come out of the NAACP boycotting of white-owned stores in the state of Mississippi. The Kansas law's legislative history reveals that its goal is to undermine the message of those participating in a boycott of Israel. This is either viewpoint discrimination against the opinion that Israel mistreats Palestinians or subject matter discrimination on the topic of Israel. So I want to commend Glenn Greenwald, who I believe is of Jewish heritage, but it's not material, who brought this to our attention today in an article at The Intercept that I'll link to in the show file for today's podcast. And we not only have the state-level laws, California has one, it's kind of toothless, it's an executive order in the state of New York, and at the federal level last year, the alleged Democrat, Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland, introduced legislation that got 43 co-sponsors, which would penalize us on the federal level. And initially, the bill called for prison sentences and large fines for anyone working with international organizations to boycott Israel. So since 2014, over 100 anti-boycott measures, like the one in Kansas, have been introduced. At least 24 have been enacted. And in 2017, there were 308 so-called suppression incidents. Here are some examples. If you were a victim of Hurricane Harvey, you were required to pledge not to boycott Israel in order to receive aid from FEMA. A New York City bookstore hid a children's book about Palestine after calls for censorship. A Palestinian-American professor here at San Francisco State was sued for researching and teaching about Palestine. And a black student leader at the University of Wisconsin was condemned for speaking out against the connections between white supremacy and Zionism. And Greenwald correctly notes that this is the most egregious assault in a very narrow way protecting one entity, the State of Israel, from the rich freedom of speech that we are supposed to enjoy in the United States under the First Amendment. And I'm very happy to see this decision. Of course, it will be appealed, and it remains to be seen how it will fare if it ever lands on the doorstep of the Supreme Court. There's another notable ruling that came from a British court on Tuesday. The mass surveillance powers, which occur under two laws, the Data Retention and Investigatory Powers Act, And then that law was replaced in 2016 by a law simply known as the Investigatory Powers Act. It expanded the government's surveillance authority further and retroactively legalized controversial spy tactics that were exposed in documents that were released by Ed Snowden. And the critics of this called it the Snooper's Charter, and it is apparent under this ruling that it will have to be reformed. And the action here was brought by a Labor member of Parliament named Tom Watson. Here are the details. The Data Retention and Investigatory Powers Act forced telecommunications companies to store records of their customers' emails and phone calls for 12 months. And the second law broadened the data retention system by allowing the government to compel phone and internet companies to store not just email and phone records, you know, metadata, but also logs showing the websites that customers visited, the apps that they used. And law enforcement could then access the information without a court order or warrant for a broad range of reasons not necessarily related to criminal activity. Now, this is as broad as we are seeing in the United States today. And while Britain does not have the same First Amendment rights of free speech, the same Fourth Amendment rights of protection against unauthorized or unconstitutional search and seizure, we do. What we have are spineless legislators, members of both parties, who just renewed the FISA law without any amendments. And we're going to get to Devin Nunes, the Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee. He was a major booster of extending the FISA law without any changes. And, of course, it's ironic because he believes that government agencies have abused intelligence and the FISA court. We'll get to that in just a couple of minutes here. So, yeah, 45 gave his first official State of the Union message last night. He rambled through that teleprompter text for over an hour and 20 minutes. It was grueling to watch. And, you know, the State of the Union message, no matter who delivers it, is a lot of puffery, a lot of blue sky, and a whole lot of beautifully served up whipped bullshit. And that's what we saw last night. And I'm not going to go into all the platitudes, the jingoistic bromides, the political mythology that Trump tried to dish up. But there are a few areas that I'm greatly concerned about. One is that he announced to the glee of the Republican side of the chamber that he has issued an executive order to the Pentagon boss, the Secretary of Defense, to keep Guantanamo open. And he used the Bush-era phrase about enemy combatants to send a clear message that he plans to detain more people and to detain more people at Guantanamo. And he used buckets of fear to try to paint the picture of how dangerous the world is and why we need it. But he, of course, is oblivious to the message that it sends to the rest of the world and the extent to which Guantanamo is the sore spot that aggravates and activates people who become our future enemies. He just can't get that. It's too complicated. So he ordered Mattis to reexamine our military detention policy to keep open the detention facilities at Guantanamo Bay and to deliver a new policy on battlefield detentions, including policies governing transfer of individuals to Guantanamo. Trump said, "Terrorists who do things like place bombs in civilian hospitals are evil. When possible, we have no choice but to annihilate them. When necessary, we must be able to detain and question them. But we must be clear. Terrorists are not merely criminals. They are unlawful enemy combatants, and when captured overseas, they should be treated like the terrorists that they are." Well, I'm sure that sounds good to people who watch cartoons and Hollywood movies, big followers of, you know, the 24 series and these other propaganda pieces that only portray Americans as the good guys and righteously watch as we smite the bad guys. And Trump, he misrepresented the history of people who left Guantanamo and, quote, went back on the battlefield. Most of those people were innocent of what they were brought to Guantanamo for, but they were radicalized while they were in American custody. Some got special torture treatment. And you wonder why they, quote-unquote, returned to the battlefield. And that term is very broad. Returning to the battlefield includes people who appeared on news programs and criticized the United States. Now, to be fair, some of the people released from Guantanamo actually did go back into battle. But for the most part, that is fiction. The other piece of fiction that he ladled out last night was depicting virtually an entire group of immigrants to the United States as dangerous members of the MS-13 gang. And what he displayed was compounded ignorance. Because he not only is ignorant, he wants to be ignorant. He's proud of his ignorance. And he's very comfortable. Painting with a broad brush, almost anyone of Latin heritage, as a potential member of MS-13. And I'm linking to a great piece published in the Washington Post today by Jose Miguel Cruz. And he is the, director of research in the Kimberly Green Latin American and Caribbean Center at Florida International University. He has been conducting research on Central American gangs for more than 22 years. He says, pointing to MS-13 to try to scare Americans into harsh new immigration restrictions, Trump is overstating the danger the gang poses here in the U.S. Worse, by using the gang to demonize all Latino immigrants, Trump is building inner-city walls that alienate communities and risk making criminal organizations more powerful, both here and overseas. And he explains that MS-13 wasn't much until the 1980s and Nancy Reagan's Just Say No campaign and the zero tolerance that was addressed toward American street gangs. So it's estimated that there are about 10,000 MS-13 gang members in the United States, less than 1% of the estimated total of 1.4 million total gang members in the country. And in a customs sweep and ICE sweep last May, only 8% of the people picked up were linked to MS-13. And he points out that the gang didn't come from south of the border. MS-13 is as American-made as Google or Trump. MS-13 was founded in L.A. in the 1980s by children of Salvadoran immigrants who fled a brutal civil war. And when they smoked a little weed and hung out like the white kids did, well, they were hustled into juvenile centers and prisons, which is where they got their PhDs in gang warfare. Yes, the idea of incarcerating people, locking them up and throwing away the key, only makes these problems worse. And then we deported many of these people after they served prison terms, and we internationalized the MS-13 gang, which is now a virulent force in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, the three nations that produce the most immigrants, including immigrants under the age of 18, fleeing violence in Central America in recent years. One of the other idiotic things that Trump tried to talk about last night was the opioid epidemic. And he got the statistics right about how many people are being killed. I think it's as many as 7 per hour on a daily basis. But what he got wrong is that he assumes that opioids are sold on the street by furtive drug dealers and some sorts of drug kingpins. But the source of the opioid crisis is white-collar crime. It's the makers of the drugs, the distributors like San Francisco-based McKesson, the pharmacy retailers who sell those drugs, the doctors who write the prescriptions that enable the peddling of millions of these pills. But Trump's idea is that these are people who, you know, want to come over the border, and that's why he needs a wall. Again, his intentional, willful ignorance is just so obvious and astounding. My last comment is that Trump treated it like a kind of revival meeting where he was the healer. And, you know, every president packs the gallery with people who make a point about a policy or a position that he is describing in the State of the Union message. But this morning, Rush Limbaugh was saying how different Trump was because he only featured heroes, no victims. It's the Democrats who are always bringing out victims to, you know, tell their sob stories. Well, one of the most obvious exploitations was when Trump identified the parents of two Long Island teenagers who were killed in a struggle with MS-13. He made them stand up and be recognized and talked about how great they were. But he was exploiting the victimization of these brown and black parents, using them as a wedge to promote discrimination against the broader group of immigrants. The fact checkers had such a hard time with Trump's speech last night that the New York Times published 19 pages of fact checking, and it took, it looks like, over a dozen reporters to pull it all together. Every day I pause for a moment to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. And I want to thank people who've renewed annual subscriptions like David Paulson, monthly supporters like Paul Tomaselli, Natalie Reel in Montana, Ethan Knox. I really appreciate your support. And I want to invite others who never hear their names mentioned here and who listen regularly and who have a little extra cash in the bank. I don't want your social security check, okay? But if you can help, I hope you will. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. No matter what platform or device you use, you'll see the menu button. Click on that. The option for Become a Subscriber appears. Click on that. You get to the sign-up page, and you've got choices. $5, $10, $20 a month, the $50 annual subscription. And by the way, if you use the Peter B. Collins app, our app master and webmaster, John Gorenfeld, is whipping up a new and improved Peter B. Collins app 2.0. And that is for the iPhone and the iPad. It's also going to be accessible by Android phone users. And most importantly, it will play in the background. There is a flaw in the current current version of the PBC app, and it is annoying. I have to say, when I use it, it won't play in the background, and then when your device wants to go to sleep, it shuts down the feed. So we are addressing that, and I'm looking forward to announcing the release sometime in February. Well, today I am announcing a new collaboration with the investigative journalism site Who What Why. Russ Baker and his team have impressed me over the years, and they invited me to produce a series of interviews for Who What Why. The first episode is available today, and I'm linking to it in the show file for today's podcast. My guest is Bay Area reporter Darwin Bond Graham, who writes for the East Bay Express. And we talk about five recent cases of alleged domestic terrorism here in the Bay Area. And they all follow a little playbook or a script with paid informants. In some cases, they were tipped by people who monitor social media and turn people in. And in many cases, these are people whose stories are so far-fetched that they deserve deeper scrutiny. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Darwin Bond Graham.
I'm familiar with Trevor Aronson's work, and I think he's done at the national level, you know, a really thorough analysis of a lot of these cases. And yeah, if you drill down to particular cases, you will see that typically they involve an individual who is identified often by a confidential source or a random tip to the FBI as having expressed some sort of, idea about, oh, I want to go overseas and join this group and fight with them, or I want to use a bomb and commit some kind of act of violence, or I want to obtain firearms, or I have firearms. Once they make that statement that indicates some sort of plan toward violence, regardless of how credible it is, the FBI's position is, oh, well, we have to follow this and see where it leads. And so then you see the use of confidential informants, paid informants. In one of the cases I looked at, the FBI was paying the individual's employer, who was a plumbing contractor,
right,
to just routinely inform the FBI about, you know, this individual's statements on the work site. So yeah, paid informants is a big thing. And then, yeah, I mean, if the FBI pulls the trigger on a case and decides they're gonna, you know, take it all the way, then you get to the point where you have multiple undercover agents posing as terrorists, helping an individual devise a plan, and then literally providing like most of the materials. I can't speak, you know, as you know, Aronson has done. I can't speak to like the total number of cases nationally and patterns that I've seen in them, but in the Bay Area, it's definitely the case that the limited number of terrorism prosecutions in the last 10 years or so, these were not individuals who had some pre-existing link or connection to an overseas foreign terrorist organization. They weren't sophisticated criminals. They didn't already exist in some kind of, you know, terror cell like we saw with 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
These were like random guys. Most of them were, pretty much all of them were, mentally ill or extremely depressed. They made some offhand statements about wanting to do violence, and that's what set them on that track. So yeah, there's that is definitely the pattern you see in these investigations and prosecutions.
You can hear the full interview with reporter Darwin Bond Graham. Follow the link to whowhatwhy.org in the show file at peterbcollins.com. And one of the cases I discussed with Bond Graham is the recent case just before Christmas last year that involved a man named Everett Jameson from Modesto. And he was accused of planning an Islamic State-inspired terror attack on a tourist attraction, Pier 39, in San Francisco. And that case reminded me of one of the early domestic terrorism cases in our region. It goes all the way back to 2003-2004, and it was a father and son. The son is Hamid Hayat. His dad was Umar Hayat. And the accusation was that the young man had gone to Pakistan and attended a terrorism training camp. Only the story was full of holes. Paid FBI informants, of course, were part of the picture. And the most astounding evidence that is being presented at an appeal hearing that is underway right now is that the terrorist training camp that he was accused of attending in 2003 and 2004 was closed in 2002. And the government did not share that evidence with the defense or with the jury. And we see that pattern play out in case after case. And further coverage of the appeal from the Sacramento Bee today talks about a family member, a relative of Hamid Hayat, whose name is Ismail. And he was with Hayat in Pakistan and said flatly it's not possible that he attended a terrorist training camp. He was there trying to find a bride. And if you've seen the new movie, The Big Sick, you can get an idea of the cultural pull of the arranged marriages in that particular culture. The FBI spoke out today against the memo that is circulating, but not yet public, in Washington. The 3.5-page memo from Devin Nunes' staff at the House Intelligence Committee. And it's been widely leaked. We believe it criticizes the FBI for using the Christopher Steele dossier in its application at the FISA court for a warrant to surveil Carter Page, who was part of the Trump campaign. And the FBI is objecting because the FBI is the subject of this memo. And you can expect that they want to throw up all kinds of roadblocks and smoke screens. Now, I have two minds here. I am no defender of the FBI. But I also believe that the Democratic critics of Nunes' memo probably have some legitimate complaints that this is a memo that doesn't tell the whole truth. It cherry-picks information in a way that embarrasses the FBI. And as I've pointed out, if they were simply to release the FISA court applications, we're now told the second one occurred in October, just 4 to 5 weeks before the election. Those dates and the details of the application are critical. And, of course, this is also a delightful internecine squabble between the White House, its FBI, and its Justice Department. And so nobody's going to come out of this smelling very good. That's one prediction that I'm willing to make at this point. At the New York Times today, Charlie Savage is speculating that the real aim of the memo is to discredit the Mueller investigation. And it goes into some detail, and it quotes the reliable Democrat promoter of the Trump-Russia narrative, Adam Schiff, who is the ranking Democrat on House Intelligence. He says the memo contains both inaccurate assertions and material omissions to misleadingly impugn law enforcement officials. And as you know, I think that law enforcement officials routinely violate the law and get away with it. So I'm not one to exonerate the FBI. At the same time, these are highly partisan charges that are being pursued. And we get a little more detail on the way that Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, is implicated here, because he signed off shortly after he took the job as number two at Justice to extend the surveillance of Carter Page. And that is inferred or interpreted as being the resubmission of the Steele dossier to the FISA court for the purpose of extending the coverage of Page. That may or may not be true, but I find that interesting. So we will see where all this leads. Trump promised a member of Congress last night as he was exiting the State of the Union that the memo will be released. But then Sarah Huckabee Sanders today said, well, he hasn't actually seen it yet, so who knows? Good news for Bob Menendez, the slimy Democrat who holds the Senate seat, one of them, from New Jersey. He, of course, was tried last year over corruption related to his friend, Dr. Salomon Melgen. And the jury deadlocked, 10-2. The government announced it would re-prosecute Menendez, but after the judge in the case dismissed 7 of 18 charges that Menendez was facing, the Justice Department has moved to dismiss the rest of the charges and vacate the plan for a new prosecution. After a week of public criticism over her failure to deal with a sexually harassing staff member who was on her 2008 campaign for president and again worked on a super PAC for Hillary Clinton in 2016. Hillary Rodham Clinton has said that if she were given a second chance, she would have fired her faith advisor during the 2008 campaign. Now, that's fair enough. At the same time, there is this whole problem with Hillary Clinton. The reason she hasn't joined the Me Too movement is she's got this ball and chain named Bill. And I'm linking to a column by the columnist at the Washington Post, Alyssa Rosenberg, headlined, "Hillary Clinton and I Are Done." And she writes, "After last week, the revelation she failed to take her campaign manager's advice and fire an aide accused of sexual harassment, Hillary Clinton and I are done. And to be honest," she says, "it's probably overdue." And she offers quite a bit of rationalization about how much room she gave Hillary Clinton and how she tried not to blame her for her husband's problems. But she said, while Clinton is not responsible for Strider's conduct, he's the faith counselor, she is responsible for ignoring recommendations from her national director of operations and her campaign manager. And Rosenberg goes on, "Clinton has been unfairly saddled with the weight of a lot of terrible decision-making by men. But it doesn't balance the scales to say that Clinton shouldn't be held accountable for the choices she made and the advice she shrugged off as the chief executive of her own presidential campaign." From Las Vegas, news that a court has unsealed some documents that show that investigators following the October 8th shooting spree by Stephen Paddock were pursuing a couple of other people. And as you know, I remain unconvinced that the government story is complete, that Stephen Paddock was the sole gunman there. Because the real-time accounts, the police radio calls, the eyewitness accounts indicated that shots were coming from more than one direction. At any rate, the person involved here is a guy named Douglas Haig, and despite the fact that he was his name was suppressed in court documents, reporters have discovered that he runs an Arizona ammunition shop, and that Stephen Paddock bought about 1,000 rounds of tracer ammunition from him. And finally today, an update on the recent reports about Scott Lloyd, Trump's appointee in charge of the Office of Refugee Resettlement. Lloyd's only claim to fame is that he's a longtime anti-abortion activist. And in running this department, he ends up as the point man, the decision maker, regarding cases of teenage immigrants, females, who are pregnant and who desire to have an abortion. And under American law and constitutional precedent, they are entitled to that. But Scott Lloyd believes that his biblical interpretation of the law is more important than the Constitution. And get this, we know that he tried to intervene to prevent at least four of these teenage females from having an abortion. And in one case, he got involved at the point after the first of the two drugs for a pharmaceutical abortion had been taken by this young woman. And he wanted to find out if they could abort the abortion that was in process. He had his staff do some research to find out if the wives' tale that you can give this person who's taken the first pill a big dose of estrogen, and that will reverse the abortion that is in process. This is unscientific. It is unproven at this point that it would have the impact that he desired. But the idea that he would insert himself in the middle of a case where a woman is exercising her constitutional right to have an abortion and try to impose his beliefs, his value system, is just so over the top, out of line, and it's probably happened again since these cases became public. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. We give it away free every day, and it's available on YouTube. I hope you'll subscribe on YouTube. I'd appreciate it.
Trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.